Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. My guest for this week's episode is Daniel Carcillo. He is the CEO and founder of Wasana Health, which is looking to help get athletes and those who have had traumatic brain injury access to psychedelic healthcare and psychedelic therapy. So we have a conversation about that. And I will say before we get into the actual interview itself that I don't think that Daniel quite understood that I like to have long form conversations here on the Entheogenic Evolution, and that often interviews go well beyond an hour into an hour and a half or even up to 2 hours. And I think he was planning on something a little bit shorter, so I felt like it did get cut a little bit short, and we didn't really get to all the topics that I wanted to get to, but still had him for about an hour or so, and I think it's an interesting conversation, and I'm happy to bring it to you here on the podcast. As I mentioned last week, I'm actually off. I'm on vacation with my family right now. So if you have made a contribution in support of this podcast over the past week or so, I'm not able to thank you now because I'm recording this before you've done it. But if you have, thank you very much. And I'll get to you, of course, next week and thanking you here on the podcast when I return. This is a listener-supported podcast. If you'd like to make a contribution in support of the work that I do and putting this out there and helping to pay for bandwidth and storage, just stop by my personal webpage, martinball.net, and use the PayPal link, or join up over at Patreon. There's links for both at the top right of my personal webpage. And as I mentioned last week, coming up actually tomorrow, since this is coming out on Monday, February 21st, on Tuesday, February 22nd, is the You Are Not Your Trauma online event that is taking place. It is organized by Genevieve Solomon. I was one of the people that she brought on for an interview to discuss trauma and particularly how it relates to psychedelic medicines and psychedelic therapies. And we kind of discussed the basic trauma of being human and being self-aware and how non-dual experiences and transcended experiences help us to release that trauma and more comfortably live with who and what we are as human beings. And so the website for that is youarenotyourtrauma.org. And again, that's happening on Tuesday, February 22nd. And of course, speaking of that kind of thing, anybody out there who is looking to have somebody to talk to help integrate or even prepare for their psychedelic experience, of course, I am always available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations. You can learn more at my website for my consultation services at nondualentheogenicintegration.com. And just shoot me a message, and we will set up a time where you and I can have a video chat and talk about your experience and help give you some reflection on where you are in your process and what you can do to help integrate your experience and really express your energy in an authentic and embodied way. All right, those are all the announcements that I have for right now. Lots more great interviews coming up on the podcast in the coming weeks. So, of course, stay tuned, and thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. And let's go ahead and get into this conversation with Daniel Carcillo from Wasana Health. Enjoy. Daniel, welcome to the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. You now join my recent litany of Daniels. Let's see, there was Daniel Schmidt, there was Daniel Murtaugh, there was, I'm forgetting another Daniel now. I had a whole bunch of Daniels in a row. And so we've had a little bit of a break from Daniels, excuse me, but now we're back with another Daniel. So I hope that doesn't make you feel any less special than you are, because I know you're a special human being. But for whatever reason, there's just been a lot of Daniels here on the podcast in the past couple of months. So welcome to the club.
Thank you, man. Yeah, it's a solid name. So, yeah, feeling pretty good about the name.
Just curious, do you mostly use Daniel or do you use Dan? Do you use Danny? All three? Any preferences?
Daniel, for sure.
Daniel. Yeah. You know, I've always been one to go for the full name. I like calling people by their full names. And man, I'm just not into it if people try and call me Marty. I just correct them right away. It's like, no, I am not a Marty. I'm Martin. You can call me Martin or Martin or Martine or, you know, anything along those lines, but don't call me Marty because
Yeah, when I played in junior, there was a Danny on our team, and so I got Danny for a few years. But I prefer my given name, Daniel.
All right. Well, it's nice to have you here, Daniel. I'm glad that you could join me today. And you know, it's only audio out on the podcast here, but I'm sitting here looking at you on video, and I can see we've got some trophies behind you there, and I see a Sports Illustrated, and that's really what we're going to be talking about today is sports-related injuries and access to psychedelic medicine and healthcare. And my understanding is that you are the founder of Wisana Health and formerly a National Hockey League player. Is that all correct information?
Yes, sir. Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, let's start by just talking about your own background in hockey and kind of what got you into the area of psychedelic healthcare for sports professionals.
So grew up in Canada, you know, and you come out of the womb, and when you can walk, you can wear skates. So, you know, started pretty early, around 3 years old, and ended up moving away from home, gravitated to the sport pretty quickly, moved away from home at, 15, turning 16, to pursue my dream of, you know, becoming a professional hockey player and getting out of the small town that I grew up in, King City, Ontario, which is, you know, an amazing place, had a really amazing childhood. And, yeah, just really gravitated towards the sport. I gravitate towards, it seems like, areas in life where the normal rules don't apply, if you will. And so here was a sport where, you know, you can put your shoulder through somebody. It's like the best anger management if somebody's touching a puck. And I seem to be, you know, really good at that. And I just really liked working with a team towards a common goal, similar to kind of what we're doing with Wisana now. I ended up enjoying, you know, a pretty good semi-pro career in junior. Got drafted my first year to the NHL, 73rd overall in the world. And, you know, there were some trying times there. You know, obviously with entheogens, there's a lot of people get attracted or called to do them because of trauma. And that was no different in my life. You know, there was a lot of sexual, physical, verbal abuse throughout. Hockey's very cult-like. And that first year, you know, kind of turned me into this person that I don't recognize right now, but really helped me for sure to become, you know, car bomb and really, you know, excel in the sport. As far as I was an enforcer in the NHL for 9 years, fought 164 times and protected myself and teammates to allow them to do the job that they needed to do. And, you know, along with that, in 164 fights, bare knuckle, comes, you know, physical trauma. And I was forced to retire in 2015 from the NHL at the age of 30 after my 7th diagnosed concussion. And I was dealing with things like light sensitivity, slurred speech, headache, head pressure, insomnia, impulse control issues, anxiety, depression, and then ultimately suicidal ideation. And I've spent the last 8 years on a brain health journey to understand, number one, what had happened to me from a concussion pathology standpoint, and then number two, how I can fix it and advocate and provide hope to the TBI community for just alternative treatments. And so, you know, I was 5 years in to this journey in the year 2000 and 20, and I just came to a roadblock where I was almost bankrupt and divorced, and became really suicidal. The number one cause of death after traumatic brain injury is suicide. I really believe it's because we just don't understand the symptomology that's associated with taking hits to the head, and people just don't get diagnosed because we never get asked about it at the doctor's office. And so I was advocating pretty passionately, and you know, when I thought I was hopeless and done, luckily, I had a former teammate reach out, and he asked me to come partake in a ceremony and thought he could help me. So I did. I did 5.6 grams of penis envy, and it was amazing. I woke up the next day. I described it as feeling the way I should. Then I started to, you know, outreach and research, really, what this medicine was doing and how it could make my symptomology lessen in intensity or all but fade away within a 2-week period. And I also understood that, you know, nothing gets fixed in 5 hours. So there's continued work with a microdose and some CBD, functional mushrooms, changing my diet, being intentional. And then, you know, I ended up started testifying in front of, you know, the DC Board of Elections for Initiative 81 and got pretty deep into decrim and met MAPS and Rick. And then I just realized, you know, like this could help, you know, thousands of people that route, but concussion survivors need a diagnosis, a better diagnosis, and we need a prescription and a medicine, and one that doesn't increase the suicidal ideation that I spoke about. So I decided to, you know, go public and found a company that's going now through the FDA process to create one of those pharmaceuticals and to help the millions of concussion survivors out there. And yeah, I'm happy to report for anyone listening here. It's been a long journey with the company, and we're just kind of having a coming out party this year, but we have a meeting with the FDA set for our pre-IND meeting on the regimen that I've used, high and low dose psilocybin in combination with CBD, set for March 11th. So they're going to sit down and listen to us and give us direction on how I can actually bring this pharmaceutical to market. So yeah, I mean, that's a high level overview of who we are and what we're doing. And I feel really blessed to have found this recovery and have a platform to talk about it. So thank you for having me on.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit more about sports, and I'll just start with a confession. I am not a sports guy. I'm one of those people who, you know, when the Olympics come on, I watch some of the Olympics and find that kind of interesting. But I myself, I've never really been into sports. I was on a soccer team when I was a kid, and man, were we losers. We lost every game except for two that we tied, and that was like the year I did soccer. And I was always larger, you know, I've always been tall, I've always been a big guy. So like when I was going through school, all the older kids were always like, you're gonna do football, right? You're gonna do football, right? And I was like, well, yeah, I guess so. And then I tried out on the football team, and I quickly found out, this was in junior high, I found out like right away that I just don't have the aggressive, passionate drive to be on a football team. You know, it's just was not my thing. And that was like the last time I was ever involved in any kind of organized sports. But something that just caught my ear that you mentioned, that you said that often sports teams have like a cult-like mentality, and that issues of abuse were not really addressed. And what it calls to mind is, you know, reading stories about, you know, even with the Olympics, that here we have, you know, these doctors and these coaches that are abusing these athletes. And it's been going on for years. And we've also had a number of cases at prominent universities where coaches turned out they've been abusive. So I was wondering if you could share, like, especially like with someone like me, who's like not a sports person, what goes on in, because I know that there's a strong appeal for a lot of people of that sense of camaraderie, that sense of being part of a team. And as you say, like working towards a shared goal. So there's a lot of positive things that people get out of that. But tell us a little bit more about that darker side of what you describe as like a cult-like mentality.
Yeah, hockey's unique in the way, like, number one, it's rich white kids that get to play, or well-off white kids, right? Because the rinks cost a lot of money to upkeep, the registration's a lot of money, so you don't see much in the way of you know, other cultures being attracted to the sport. So that creates an environment of racism that's pretty prolific throughout. And then, you know, it's always been, you know, this hazing mentality where, you know, you think about it now, right? People are talking about it, but think back to the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, when it was really bad, right? And then you think to who was coaching me growing up. It's these traumatized men who never really dealt with anything. You don't talk about if you're hurt in hockey. Like, hockey's an extremely rough sport. There's no out of bounds. You're going to get hurt, right? And you don't talk about it, you know, you just move forward. That being said, like, I accepted that part, but the part of your teammates really leaning on you and abusing you on a daily basis and saying things like, you know, don't worry, you'll be able to do it to the rookie next year. So it's just this ongoing cycle of abuse. I mean, it's not specific, it's specific to pro sports, but specific in life, you know, you know, I love my parents. They did amazing, right? They were Italian and they hit me and they didn't realize how angry that made me. But I stopped that cycle of abuse in my family. I do not hit my kids, you know, and that's not easy to do. So similar to hockey, it's just, you know, you hit me, I hit you next year, right? And you just pass this abuse on, and I'm no angel, right? Like, I lean on people verbally the next year. And then when you get to 15, 16, you're talking about kids that are away from their house, right? Away from all their friends and family, going to a totally new high school on the verge of achieving their dream. You know how much power that coach has over us? Right. And like with one swift phone call, you could be done. The hockey world's extremely small. And with one word, uncoachable to scouts, you're dead. So this coach in junior, Jeff Perry, really breeded a culture that and he's still coaching, by the way, in Hockey Canada kids, just breeded this culture that was just extremely toxic. And all the guys, you know, bought into it. He partook in the abuse, and you know, it's unfortunate. It's how hockey is. I like to think things are changing, but I don't know. And so I tell my story because hopefully, you know, it'll bring about change. You can tell your story to a point, but, like, you know, I've been ostracized by the hockey community, and I accepted that when I went public.
Yeah.
So the only way to hold these guys accountable is through lawsuits, right? So we filed a class action lawsuit in Canada. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we do well there and we're able to change the course. We're able to change the reporting of abuse. And I mean, just quite simply, you know, change the way that you're able to report something without having the fear of retribution, without having the fear of somebody calling these NHL scouts and your dream being over. So there's a lot that goes into it, right? But that's kind of just a high level overview of what happens. And then there's a big part of me too that's like, well, you know, who would you have been in the NHL if you didn't have that abuse? You know, would I have been so successful? And I don't think so. I don't know truly, but it was a big part of me, still is. So, you know, what this medicine's been able to do is like help me accept that and help me accept that without that, I probably wouldn't have fought 164 times. I wouldn't have gotten all the TBIs I did. I wouldn't have been called to the medicine and I wouldn't have got better. And then I wouldn't be on the verge of bringing a pharmaceutical that's going to help millions of people, you know? So then you just become grateful. It's the amazing thing about the retrospective aspect of what this medicine can do if done with intention.
Yeah, it's powerful to then be able to look back on those elements that shaped you through that process and then be able to see the good from it. But it certainly sounds like it's a difficult kind of culture to be in, to have such a radical power imbalance. You know, mm-hmm. I went through something a little bit similar as a graduate student in grad school, that your personal advisor ends up being able to determine your future. And I had an abusive advisor who really negatively impacted my ability to go on and get a job. So I can definitely identify at that level of, well, do I speak out about this person? What do I do? This person holds my future in their hands. And also, it just makes me think of just the power imbalance that happens in sports and schools in general. Like thinking back to my own high school experience, you know, I was one of the nerds, you know, the brainiac types, and I was part of, I forget the name of it, but it was some academic club, and there was one day where we were supposed to go to this regional competition, you know, and answer a bunch of questions about shit. I don't even know what it was about. But we didn't get to go because the buses were being used that day by the football team. And the football team had priority over academics. And honestly, as a student, it really pissed me off. Like,
I mean, yeah, it's I was a nerd too, man. I was in the drama class and I was on a roll and I loved school, you know, like, but I mean, the reality too is like the world, right? What's it driven by? It's driven by money. Yeah. What brings the most money, right? And so like you just date it back, you know, and it's unfortunate, you know, and I'm sorry that happened to you, but yeah, I mean, I experienced similar things, you know. I walked in like fashion shows. I did stuff that like I got made fun of big time, right? But when I went back to the room, the hockey room, you know, but I didn't care. I just, you know, went about my way. I'm interested in a lot of different things, you know, and I think that's what makes me unique and probably makes you unique, you know.
Yeah, and probably aids in what it is that you were doing now. In reaching into healthcare, mental wellness, and all the rest of that, that you're a well-rounded individual, that you didn't have your complete identity wrapped up in the hockey and in the sports, but you had broader interests, and so you were able to walk between these different worlds.
Yeah, I think that's really important. You know, I think I was always a curious kid. And, you know, it's probably annoyed the heck out of my parents. I don't ask all these questions and, you know, but, I just read a lot and, I tried to expand my mind for sure.
Yeah. So in sort of dealing with the abuse and the violence and then just the repercussions of that, you know, going out into the rink, taking it out there, getting into fights, having these head injuries, I'm always curious about people's personal stories. So you've mentioned some of it so far, but I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about then what you were experiencing as an individual that then drove you to doing work with the psilocybin mushrooms. And I want to ask you more about that experience itself, if you're comfortable sharing. But I'm interested in if you could describe a little bit more about what you were experiencing as someone with traumatic injury.
Yeah. You know, so like early in my career from 20 to 25, I had ACL reconstructive surgery. My PCL got blown out, did my MCL on my right knee seven times.
Okay. Okay. Hold on. But what do those letters mean?
So, it's just a ligament that basically holds your knee in place from the side.
Okay.
You know, and you can injure it a lot. I had arthroscopic hip surgery. Got numerous tears in my neck. And I mean, you know, so with that, like in surgeries, you know, you get prescribed a lot of opiates and all this stuff. So I had addiction issues, during my career. And then, you know, after my career, because I was dealing with so many things that I didn't understand, you know, on top of the anxiety and depression, you have headache, head pressure, light sensitivity, slurred speech, you have headaches. You have, this impulse control issues that I never had off the ice. You have insomnia, and you try to numb that out with agents that you know that work. And so I tried that for 6 months, and then just eventually, before I realized, you know, I was going to kill myself, I keep going down this path. It was, you know, everyone's got an aha moment. My son was almost 9 months. No, yeah, almost 9 months. And he, 9 months old, and he like looked at me, and I can just tell him like, oh, this guy's like, what is wrong with you? You know? And, so I packed a bag the next day and I went and, you know, got healthy and, healthy enough to, you know, then assess my brain and what had happened. That's not easy for a 30-year-old, you know? And you know, after I did that, the first 2 years is really just about my body getting back, you know, like just accepting that this real world that you're in now moves a lot slower. People don't talk the same way. You know, you have to do things like, you know, simple tasks like go to the bank and grocery shopping, and people aren't cooking you breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And, you know, purpose. You've got to repurpose yourself, which I think is huge. And so, I did all that, but still found myself very unhappy. And again, I was spending so much money on these treatments that doctors are telling me to do that they guaranteed would help me regain my brain health. And then when you're done, right, like, and you spend $9,000 a week and nothing really happens and it's gone, it's frustrating. So got to this place where, again, I was just, fed up, suicidal. With TBI, because I was doing so many things and I wasn't getting better, eventually, had an angel and a wife to stick by me. But eventually, right? Like, people don't want to hang out with you, her friends, family. You start feeling like a burden to everybody. Mm-hmm. And so then I started to just make plans over a 2 or 3 week period to end my life and make sure that my kids didn't keep seeing me living this way. And I just thought it'd be better off without me. I just, when I got called to psilocybin, it was, I was suicidal, extremely suicidal, extremely depressed, extremely, dealing with a lot of anxiety. And, to that point, it was probably the most difficult 3 hours of my life, when I actually did the medicine, cause it tends to exasperate what's at the forefront of your mind and show you exactly what's wrong. And then the last 30 minutes was beautiful, but it was a pretty arduous trip, for sure. And I say that because a lot of these companies, a lot of people talk about how beautiful it is, and it can be, mm-hmm. if you can integrate what you see, but if you're called to it in a space, in a mental space like I was, I also like punishment, I like suffering, which sounds weird, but I just do. I'm comfortable being uncomfortable, So, I was dealing with a lot. I was dealing with a lot for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting as you're kind of mentioning all these different surgeries and these different therapies and these different things that were going wrong. I kind of get the impression that, you just rattle them off so nonchalantly. It seems like these are considered rather normal for people playing hockey to have these kinds of issues. Would that be correct?
Yeah, there's a lot of hip surgeries. Whoever put us on this earth, why we're here, is they didn't make us to skate, right? They made us to run in a straight line. So we have tons of hip issues, knee issues, shoulder issues. There's no out of bounds, like I mentioned before. Teeth, gone, a lot of head injuries. A lot of neck issues, hand, like I've got tons of arthritis all over my body and I'm 36, going on 37. So, you just have to, but it's manageable, right? Like I knew I signed up for that. Like, let's be honest, I knew that I was going to come out of the game like that and you just manage it with yoga. And I don't do like CrossFit and stuff like that anymore, but, you move, right? You move, you keep the arthritis from building up. And then you take anti-inflammatories and antioxidants and medicine that decreases the inflammation in your body and brain. And that's, and then, hopefully you get to a point that I'm at where I've never felt better. I've really never felt better. I've never been more productive. I've never had better memory, cognitive, focus, creativity, relationships, close relationships with my wife and kids, and being able to be in the moment is important, I'm, long-winded answer or way of saying it was all necessary, it was all necessary to get to this point.
Yeah. So in the psychedelic therapeutic world, there's often this statement of don't work with anybody who has suicidal ideation. That's often listed as, well, you don't want to work with somebody who's schizophrenic. You don't want to work with somebody who's suicidal. You don't want to work with somebody who's on too many psychiatric meds and things like that. But kind of similar to your story, there actually are a lot of stories, and I've spoken with people here on the podcast who have been in the same place where they said, well, look, I was at the point where I was ready to do it. I was ready to either die or jump in and see what this sort of, for many people, sort of this last ditch effort, like, well, I'm going to try this. And if that doesn't work, well, then I've already got my plans made. And it sounds like you were at that point. And so I think it's an important part of the story to tell, especially again, when, you know, as psychedelic therapy is going to become more normalized and regulated, that, you know, that's going to be one of these things that's put out there as well. Somebody with suicidal tendencies should not be receiving psychedelic therapy. Yet for so many people, that has been what has helped move them on to the next stage of their life.
Do you know about MAPS data?
Yeah.
Like MDMA for PTSD?
Yeah.
So they lean in on that, right? They pick the worst patients.
Yeah.
Right. And then I don't know if you read the Compass data. They did the opposite, right, with psilocybin and their patient selection. And they made a lot of mistakes, you know, and that's a big reason why their data wasn't compelling at all. So, you know, I'm a big believer in working with people that understand and use this medicine. And MDMA is not psilocybin, and it's not 5-MeO. And I've been to Tarapoto, the high jungle of Peru, and done ayahuasca, and experienced 5-MeO, and experienced, you know, intramuscular IV ketamine and intranasal, experienced MDMA, and it's like, it's all a part of the journey. But yeah, to your point, man, I mean, when we make patient selection for our trials, like, we're not going to make that same mistake that everybody else is. And I just believe, because I can, you know, I've done over 100 ceremonies on myself now. And I just understand how this works. And in the people that it works with, like, you know, I've worked with a lot of suicidal people, and it's tough sometimes, you know, to guide them through, but as long as you can hold the space for them and create an environment, that they feel safe in, you know, in my case, has had a really good outcome.
Yeah. So you're definitely not of the opinion that that is an automatic disqualifier. And really, for some of these therapies, maybe that's the baseline of kind of what we're looking for, is for people who are on that edge, and then giving them a transformative experience to help pull them out.
Yeah, it's just listen, man, a big reason why I decided to go public as a company is because I was so sick and tired of seeing this narrative from all these other companies, you know, we're taking the trip out, and we're taking the hallucination out, and all this stuff. It's like, wow. I mean, that's not it. You know, the medicine is supposed to show you what's wrong. And then you integrate that, you prepare on the front end, and then you integrate the lessons that you saw into your life. When I went home, it wasn't like, la-di-da, skipping through sunflowers, like, and I'm fixed. It's not that. You know, I just constantly kept in my mind these new positive thought patterns that I had. I couldn't understand why they were positive now, because I am so used to calling myself, you know, really bad stuff to motivate myself, right? Because that's just what I was used to get called in hockey. And I don't do that anymore, you know. Positively just, you know, think and reinforce and manifest all of these different missions that I want to try to achieve, you know.
Yeah, so it sounds like there was even sort of an internalized brutal dictator in there.
Oh yeah.
To self-motivate. And that, it sounds like that might be common in the sports world or in hockey, to kind of internalize that and to get yourself pumped up and ready for battle, essentially.
Yeah, man. I mean, you got to understand too, right? Hockey, you could die. You could very easily die on the ice, right? There's sharp blades, and you can break your neck. Hundreds of people have been paralyzed, and you're moving at 35 miles an hour with 9 other guys, usually putting a puck into an area that they're going to, all the while not getting your head taken off. And it's not an easy sport. It's not an easy sport. And I approached it that way, it's either me or you, and it's not going to be me.
Yeah. And it sounds like that's part of the appeal for young men in joining in that sport, that it has sort of that thrill of battle to it.
Yeah, that was amazing, man. And I mean, I get that now, you know, I wake up every day, it's just different. It's positive. It's, and I just have my shit together, you know, and I need to, because now I'm managing a team that has a different mission, you know, and it's even more important than winning any tin cup, you know, for sure. So, yeah.
Well, if we could talk about that first transformative experience for you and kind of writing off of that idea. I mean, actually, just even before we got on here, I was just reading an article, I think it was on Vice, and it was talking about how, you know, lots of the new coming online psychedelic companies, that they are trying to create novel psychedelics that, in a sense, they're looking for the therapeutic potential, but that maybe doesn't have the quote unquote psychedelic effect to it. So to take the psychedelics out of psychedelics, but the idea that that's going to be providing people greater access to the healthcare benefits of psychedelics. But you definitely seem to be of the opinion that, well, it's sort of the rigor of the psychedelic experience and what you see and experience there that was crucial.
Yeah. I mean, listen, that was crucial. And then we have there's a low dose therapy, right? That's non-hallucinogenic. I've seen it help hundreds of people, right? Over a longer period of time, but I've seen it help a lot of people, right? With these symptoms. So for sure, there's something to be said, but we don't deuterate the molecule. We don't change it. It's not a different crystalline form, right? Like, we don't change anything about it. We just combine it. Our strategy is to combine these natural things found in both, you know, nature and psilocybin, and then cannabinoids. And when you combine it, you know, you have something novel that you can protect, because in pharma, you have to protect things, you know, in order to get investment and go through this. And so that's what we do. That's our strategy, you know. And, you know, cannabinoids fit into this endocannabinoid system, right? And then psilocybin is a lock and key with serotonin. And, like, you know, most people get this gut rut or stomach aches after they eat psilocybin. That's because 90% of our serotonin receptors are in our stomach. Not a lot of people realize that, you know, there's only 10% in our brain. So to that point, we've evolved with both of these medicines. And I would be remiss to say, if I tried to tweak any of that, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So we don't, you know, we don't.
Yeah. So with that 5.6 grams experience, I wonder if there's anything you'd be comfortable sharing with us about that. I mean, you have described it as difficult and somewhat harrowing, and that you were up for that.
Yeah. I mean, my whole body was shaken, you know, trying to reject what was coming. And it was scary, you know, just the feeling of the onset. And then I was in a place I was totally lost in my life. You know, I was looking for what I was going to do next. Cause I just filed those lawsuits against, you know, the NHL and the OHL, and I knew, right, that's done. I'll never be allowed back there, nor did I want to be, but still it's a big decision to make.
Yeah.
And then, so, you know, it showed me that I was lost. Right. I was walking around in this loop. I was on this farm that I just got to that I didn't really recognize. And I just kept going around, stopping, going around, stopping. I was dry heaving a lot of energy. And then, like, my guide would put his hand on my shoulder and he'd be like, oh, like, that feels so good. You know, like, it felt like a huge hand. Like, and then, you know, when I looked at my former teammate, usually he had this long hair. It was short then, but he had this long curly hair when we played. And he came to me like he was like Jesus, you know, like Jesus Christ. And I was like, and they were just trying to guide me through it, saying things like, hey, man, this is, you know, we want you, right? Like, you know, and I remember saying in the ceremony, they were like, we want you on our team. I'm like, what? I'm like, why? I'm like, can I swear on this podcast?
Sure. Oh yeah, sure.
I'm like, I'm such a fucking loser. Why? Why do you want me? You know? And, yeah, they just, you know, they helped me kind of guided me through what was really difficult. And then eventually I believed them, you know, I was like, oh, okay. I'm like, so this is a new team. Right. Like, they explained it, you know, this network. And it's like, okay, you know, and then I kind of laid back. I remember, and all this happened, like, this is like 2.5 hours, 3 hours of like this constant. Right. And then, I said, okay, you know, I'll be on your team. And then I lied down and they put something on the TV, and it was just like heaven. It was like the clouds opened up, and it was I accepted it. I was asleep 30 minutes later because it was just the intensity of the heaving and the emotions and stuff like that. But yeah, and then we you know, I spent a bunch of time in the coming weeks. Well, I spent over a week on the farm, and then in the coming weeks, just communicating. And you know, me and the PhD biochemist are best friends now, and you know, we constantly talk, and so we're still integrating, I guess. And yeah, it was saved my life, man, for sure. Saved my life.
Yeah, and it sounds like the context of having the support of others, individuals there. I mean, this sounds like the kind of thing, like if you had just gone off on your own, the idea of like, you know, the looping is something that tends to happen with people that have a really difficult stuff that they need to process, where people get stuck in these loops. But it sounds like even in that, like you were describing, the dry heaving and sort of the tremors. So your body was seeking to release the energy. But this is a place, especially if it's a strong trip, that somebody could potentially really freak out and really kind of go down the rabbit hole. And it sounds like having those two individuals there, particularly having a former teammate and also having a guide, that helped you to surrender and relax into that and just more allow that to take place.
Yeah, it's crucial. It's crucial to, you know, prepare. I mean, it was a surprise, right? So I was ready for anything. So on the preparation end, it could have been more done, but that's okay because these guys were just super experienced, right? And they knew exactly what to do with me. And they guided me through it. And then they helped me integrate what I saw, make sense of it, then created an aftercare program, which I tweaked with amounts and days on, days off, et cetera. And then started down the journey of dosing myself with high doses and, you know, just reading literature. And yeah, it was, they set me on the path for sure. And I dove in and, yeah, you know, then things change, you know, when you become a CEO of a publicly traded company, you can't continue to like sit with people and stuff like that. You know, I just direct people. I still help people, connect them with the right people that I know are responsible and, you know, have responsible medicine and can help them responsibly get better. So can't complain, man.
Yeah. And it sounds like from this first experience that then you went to explore more and additional medicines and in different contexts and kind of continuing that healing process. So this was like step one, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, 7 months in, I went and did ayahuasca and I was almost going to not do it. I did it with Jesse Gould and the Heroic Hearts Project, and we funded, you know, two vets to come. I almost didn't want to because I was like, man, I feel so good, you know, and like, it was like, you don't, my dad always said, you don't fix what's not broken, right? So, you know, I didn't feel broken anymore. And I'm like, you know, you keep reading and there's layers to peel back, obviously, and continue the work. And just the whole vet athlete connection and the fact that I was still had a big fear of death because I've had a lot of friends pass away. My grandparents passed away before. I was closest with them right when my kids were being born. There's a lot of stuff I had. And so, you know, I needed to do more work. So I did that. You know, I've stacked a bunch of things on top of each other in one day. I've done combo ceremony. Like, I mean, I'm just like completely in for sure, you know? But if I like, first and foremost, I've tried to figure it out on my own. I think that's really important, right? Like, if I'm having these things, what this medicine allows me to do is make me more aware of the stress that is coming from either my relationships or my business or whatever that may be, right? And I figure it out on my own. I try to dive internally, or you could go to your therapist and try to figure that out, right? It's not like I run to this bottle of and dose myself, right? Or plan a trip, because that only happens when I can't figure it out, when I can't find the answer and it's prolonging and it's affecting my relationships and my business and these other, then I'm called to it, you know? But I think that's a really important distinction, you know, because I find a lot of people, like I talked to a lot of people who have done like 80 ayahuasca. I'm like, whoa, all right. Like I did one. I'm good for the rest of my life. Cause I saw where I'm going to go, you know, and so I'm good, you know, but yeah, I think that's important. Something important to say, but it's constant work for sure.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's come for you with sort of a different level of self-awareness and self-management. Whereas, you know, back in the sports world, there's abuse, there's pressure, you store it all up, you fire yourself up, and then you take it out on the rink, right? And here you're dealing with, how do I look into myself and see what is triggering me, what is causing my reactions, what is causing my stress, how can I relieve that? And then when you hit a wall, let's go to the medicine and see what that reveals and transform that, but not just leaning on the bottle, you know, not just, oh, there's a problem, drink ayahuasca. There's a problem, eat some mushrooms. So it's part of the regimen, but it's not the only part of the regimen. And a large part is this cultivation of self-awareness and self-responsibility for yourself and not taking it out on others, but learning how to find that balance and harmony within yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's key. It's what this medicine can help you do, right? It just like, well, quite simply, like it makes you more present. It makes you more aware of your actions, of the food you're eating, the way you're treating people, the way you treat yourself. That's the biggest thing for me. I wasn't loving myself. And so how could I love others in an intimate way? So it showed me how to love myself and calm down, man. You know, everything that's happened is necessary for you to be on this path now and hopefully help others. So,
yeah. And with the symptoms of traumatic brain injury, that's the TBI, correct? Traumatic brain injury. What are some of the symptoms of that? And then how has the psychedelic work helped alleviate some of those symptoms? I mean, I know you've mentioned some of them, but if you just want to mention them specifically.
Yeah, I mean, quite simply, like there's this neuroplastic event that happens with psychedelics, most psychedelics. And if you have brain trauma, there's areas of your brain that are shut down due to that trauma. So there's six areas of our brain, concussion, traumatic brain injuries on one area. So you have to identify that area and then you wake it back up. You can wake it back up with memory exercises or these other things that you can do in clinic that takes probably the rest of your life, and you'll go to a clinic for the rest of your life. Or you can use this type of medicine that in a ceremony can connect right and left brain hemispheres and just really, you know, help you create these go-arounds, or these workarounds, and really just wake up the system again. So, you know, in short, that's what it's kind of done. That's what it's done for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I love talking to you, man, but if I keep, if I stay on too long, my wife is going to, I got to take my boy to a golf lesson. So,
all right.
Yeah. How long do you want to go?
Oh, I go forever on these conversations, but let's go ahead and pivot, into Wisana Health and sort of the construction of that. And, what it's looking to be offering, and then I can let you go so you can take your boy to golf.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's, you know, Wisana is taking, you know, the regimen that's helped me, that has helped thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, just combining high and low dose psilocybin therapy, and in an intentional way with psychotherapy and taking it through the FDA process. We have a partnership with MAPS. We're in partnership discussions to get to a term sheet. Use MDMA for a TBI related symptom to help people even faster in the market. And then we have clinics that we own, that we wholly own in Illinois right now. Two of them, we're opening up a third. They're psychiatrist led with a heavy focus on FDA approved ketamine. So these alternative ways of healing, we take pharmacogenetics. We use a wearable in Garmin and link it into our system so that we can track people's mental health and in a meaningful way and get them back into the clinic before a crisis happens. And, you know, we use other holistic tools in our clinics like self-deprivation, hyperbaric chamber. It's not all about medicine. And then help support people through DBT and group therapy. So we create that community aspect. And I mean, in short, we're building a network of mental health clinics that don't exist yet on this earth.
Yeah. And it sounds like eventually there's going to be psilocybin involved, And ketamine is the easy access at this point because that's only schedule two. But so the future will be with psilocybin at these clinics.
Yeah, psilocybin and MDMA for sure. We'll prepare for these longer duration clinics.
Yeah, and so Wasana, is that a publicly traded company at this point?
Yeah, so we are publicly traded on the CSE under the moniker WESA, WESA, and then we are on the OTCQB under WSNAF.
And where could people go if they want to learn more or get involved at any level as someone who is looking for therapy or someone who's looking to get involved on the business end? Is that something that is out there at this point?
Yeah, for sure. So we are, so like obviously strategically I use the athletic platform to get through the stigmata associated with mental health and these psychedelics. So we have a really great partnership, ambassadorship with Mike Tyson. He's an early investor. Juliana Pena is one of our athletes, UFC champ. And then, most recently, Devlin DeFrancesco, IndyCar driver. And so, what we do is just kind of raise awareness through that platform. And then, people can go to either their pages or wisanahealth.com. They can follow me on Instagram, Daniel Carcillo 13, and to get more information. And we put out press releases pretty regularly on the work that we're doing. And we'd appreciate anybody's support to support our mission for bringing these medicines into a medical context.
Okay, well, great, Daniel. Well, thank you very much for your time today, and I hope your son enjoys his golf.
Yeah, man. Yeah, he's just getting into it, so I'm pumped to watch him.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.